Lecture 9, Language Families, Tracing Indo-European.
In various lectures, I've been talking about the Proto-Indo-European language, but you might reasonably ask, how do we know what that language was like if it's no longer spoken, given that it was not written? There's a whole industry talking about Proto-Indo-European and what it was like. There are academics who specialize in this, and you would almost think, listening to them, that there's some group of speakers of it or that we have documents of it or something like that. But in fact, we never will have documents of it, most likely. And what we know about Proto-Indo-European is based on what I think is a beautiful process of deducing what the language must have been like by looking at all of the Indo-European languages today and seeing what they have in common and figuring out what the first thing that gave birth to them would have had to look like if the modern languages look the way they do today. The way that's done is by having a familiarity with the basic tendencies in the processes that we've seen in terms of sound change in particular. As we saw, there are certain things that happen over and over again in terms of vowel weakenings and consonant weakenings and how vowels change. And if you look at the way things have happened in documented cases in languages around the world, including in Indo-European ones later in the game, then you can make reasonable assumptions about what this Proto-Indo-European ancestor must have been like. When I first started out in linguistics, I thought I wanted to be an Indo-Europeanist. I find these things so fascinating. I'm not one, but I will share with you what fascinated me 15 years ago, and this will give us a springboard for looking at some other language families. So in any case, the language is called Proto-Indo-European. And over the past 150 years, specialists have worked out what you might call a dictionary of Proto-Indo-European words. And so, one can actually almost fashion a hypothetical sentence, or two, or three, or four, in what this language would have been like. It's assumed that we can't know exactly what Proto-Indo-European would have been like. There are various issues that complicate it. But all indications are at this point that we've gotten pretty darn close. So to introduce to you what Proto-Indo-Europeanists have done and to show you how we can bring to life this language which we will never hear, let's take one word that is represented in various Indo-European languages and then let's trace that back to what the original word must have been. So for example, in Armenian, the word for sister-in-law is nu. It's just N-U. Now, properly speaking, that word is not sister-in-law in Armenian. It's actually bride. It's changed from sister-in-law to bride, and that's because semantic change is eternal. However, when you have a word that's cognate to nu in many other Indo-European languages, it is sister-in-law. So let's take, for example, Sanskrit. The word for sister-in-law was pronounced roughly snusa. So snusa. Then, in Russian, a defunct word for sister-in-law is snacha. And so more properly pronounced, taking into account what's on the page, snocha. So we had snusa in Sanskrit, snocha in Russian. Now then, in Old English, this word was snoru. And so we have these S-N-E sorts of words, and there always seems to be two syllables, snusa, snoru, snocha, all of them referring to sister-in-law. Then we have words that go a little bit further from that template. So in Latin, the word was nurus, and that sounds kind of like our Armenian nu. Then in Greek, nuos, so nurus, nuos. Then in Albanian, the word is nuse. Also in Albanian, the word actually no longer means sister-in-law, it means bride, but the relationship is clear. There was semantic drift, as always. So five of these words still mean, or when they were in the languages, meant sister-in-law. Two of them actually mean bride, but it's the same concept. And we've got these seven. So looking at these seven words, our question is, how can we figure out what the Proto-Indo-European word for sister-in-law was? One thing we know at the outset is that it was not snacha. It was not nurus, it was not nu, because it's unlikely that the word would have stayed pristine over all this time. We assume that each one of these seven words is the product of change over a vast period of time. So, what would the first word have been? So we look at all seven of these, and the first thing that we think about is, what was the first letter of it? We can take it letter by letter. We can take it sound by sound. And so we see that some of these words begin with sn. Some of them begin with n. So did the first word begin with sn, or did it just begin with n? Now, it's generally thought that the first word began with sn, and here's why. If the word began with sn, then we might expect that over time, because as we've seen, consonants often weaken, sounds often erode, new ones come in, but sounds tend to erode, we can imagine that maybe an S would have been dropped. And so it's sn, and then over time maybe the S goes away and just leaves the N. On the other hand, from what we've seen, and from what is true, for the word to have originally begun with N, then all of a sudden there's this S would be peculiar. Why would people be walking around saying a word like neeb, 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 and then start saying sneeb, sneeb, sneeb? It's unlikely. It would be unmotivated, particularly. Strange things happen all over the world, but it would be particularly unusual for that to happen in many different places, for that to happen in India and in England and in Russia. It's too improbable. However, the S dropping off, that could happen anywhere. That could practically have happened everywhere. So based on that, we assume, looking at these seven, that the first word must have begun with S-N. And so we're a considerable way in. So then we think, well, what would that first vowel have been? In some of these words, it's an U, it's a U. So snusa in Sanskrit. And then, remembering that in the Latin word, we're assuming that the S dropped off, now we have this vowel, which is an U, nurus, and nuos. And then, in Old English, it's snoru, so you have an O, and in Russian, it was snoha. And so, one way of looking at this is to suppose, well, most of these seem to have a U in that spot, then a few of them have O. Sometimes we like to say that majority rules, as it's sometimes put. If the first word had a U after that SN, then we can imagine that a few languages might have changed that U to an O. And that would be kind of natural. As you remember from one of our lectures, U is up in the top of the back of the mouth, and then O is in the middle, somewhat in the back of the mouth. So they're related sounds, even though in the alphabet they're quite separate. So you have your O. On the other hand, if it was an O, then why would so many of them change to U? So just economically, that could have happened, but economically, we like to assume that probably majority rules unless we can demonstrate why it wouldn't have. So our first three sounds in our word are going to be S, N, U. So now we're halfway there in figuring out what this hypothetical word would have been, based on, as you remember, words that are as different as Russian's snoha, and then Armenian, just nu. We're going to figure out where they came from. So then, we have to figure out what this other consonant is. And so in Sanskrit, it's snusa. And we have clearly an S kind of consonant here. And then in Old English, it's snoru. And so there's an R. And Latin's nurus has that R there too. Russian is no help at all. It's snocha. So we have this sound. And then we look at Greek, nuos, and well, there it seems that the consonant has dropped out, so that doesn't really help. And then in Albanian, we have nuse. So it seems like there are all these S's that we see in here. And so on the other hand, we also have these R's. Now what's going on with these R's? The R's are somewhat worrisome because we have to allow the possibility that maybe there was an R in here. And one of the problems is that when we're talking about a majority, in this case, it's not a majority that have the S. It's Sanskrit snusa, and then we have Albanian nuse, and then we have this, and then we have also the S in the middle for, depending on how we analyze the Greek word, then we can see the S as being in the middle. It's complex, but it's not a majority. But on the other hand, we do know some things about the R. The R that we have in snoru and in nurus is kind of mysterious. We have to nudge the data a little bit. But in Russian, there are cases where what began as an S became a H. We know that in other cases. And so that kind of gives us another S. And it's the same thing in Latin. There are cases where when you have an R between vowels, it used to be an S. And so that can kind of tip the scale and tell us that these R's are distracting us from a majority rules with S. And so if we've gotten this far, then we can say that S-N-U-S is our beginning. And that is a root, and so now we're just trying to figure out what the ending of this word was. And then you get a kind of a mystery, because this is a sister-in-law. This is a female person. And a female person, if you're a good, well-behaved Indo-European language, generally has a word that ends in a. If we're familiar with Spanish or Italian or even Russian, then we generally associate that a final sound with womanhood, and often something like an O with masculinity or us in Latin. And so we want this to be an A. And so when we look at all seven words, we think, well, snusa and snaha, well, that must really be what it used to be. But then again, it's easy to look at flutters in the data and overlook them because they're not telling us what we expect to see. But sometimes they're telling us of a reality that is more interesting than we might think. So Latin has nurus, and Greek has nuos, and even with Armenian, if you nudge the data, when you add case endings to nu, then they often begin with o. And so it's not a, it's o. So it seems that there's some sort of masculine thing going on with this word. Now, being a little hasty, we might think that's just an accident. It must have started as a feminine word, and for some reason, there's some people who started applying a masculine ending for sister-in-law. But if you think about it, why? It's such an obvious gender thing. Sister-in-laws, in most cases, with all acknowledgement made for the diversity among peoples and societies, sister-in-laws tend not to be men. And so you would assume that people are looking at these non-male people, and why in the world would they all of a sudden start adding this male ending? Why would anybody do that? Why would a few people do it? If anybody did do it, why would they be copied? It's a very peculiar thing. So on the other hand, suppose we imagine that for some reason the original word was masculine, then what we would expect is that at least some people would think, well, that isn't quite right, and get into the habit of putting a feminine ending on it instead. It would almost be curious if no one had done that. And so what this leads us to think is that really the original word for sister-in-law was marked masculine, and that's why it's inherited in various Indo-European languages in that way. And odd things are something you can put up with, like a squeaky door that you forget to oil. And so it just became a habit in many languages, but some people were sensible enough to fix it. And so that means that this is one of various cases where the gender was just peculiar. And we assume that in Proto-Indo-European, the final segments were O-S. So based on that kind of reasoning, going sound by sound by sound, we assume that the Indo-European word, Proto-Indo-European word, for sister-in-law was snusos, S-N-U-S-O-S. Now note that that word doesn't exist in any language today, but snusos is something that's valuable in allowing us to logically go from this to the various reflexes of that word today. And remember that that means that it starts as snusos, and then, well, Sanskrit, it's snusa, big deal. But in Armenian, it's just down to nu. Now, if Armenian were the only Indo-European language that existed, there's no way that we would know from nu that it had started as snusos. But if you compare it with all of its relatives, then you can get it to that point, and you have a beautiful kind of reconstruction. What we just did is often called comparative reconstruction. And in this way, we reconstruct the proto-languages of various language families. Indo-European is not the only family where this has been done, but it's been done with a particular thoroughness and diligence in Indo-European. Now, as time goes by, Indo-Europeanist theory changes, and so it's dynamic. It's not always as relatively easy as it is with snusos, and there are debates, as in all academic fields, and there are new findings. And so, for example, there is the story of Ferdinand de Saussure and his discovery of sounds in Proto-Indo-European that no one would ever have figured out before, because in a way, all the languages were like Armenian Nu. They weren't giving discrete clues. But then more was learned. So, to understand what de Saussure did, we have to think about a little quirk about languages, which is that languages have preferences as to how they build syllables. And so, for example, in Japanese, the only consonant that a syllable can end in is N. And so, for example, udon noodles or something like that. Other than that, words end in a vowel. So, arigato, thank you. Sushi, kamikaze. If you think about it, a Japanese word doesn't end in D. It doesn't end in P. If you hear a word like kalup, that doesn't sound Japanese because it isn't, because it doesn't end in a vowel. In Chinese, most words, depending on what you want to call a word, have just one syllable. And there are many languages in Southeast Asia where there's this monosyllabic preference. So, there are patterns that you see. Now, Proto-Indo-European is gone. We don't know who spoke it, but it was a language. We assume that it was a language just like the languages that we have today. So it would have had a syllable preference, and it does seem to. Specifically, when we reconstruct the roots of Proto-Indo-European, what we tend to see is that there is this pattern where you have consonant, vowel, consonant. That's how the roots go. So we've seen good old bear to carry. Well, that's B, if you want to call it that, E, R. That is typical. So it's not just that bear was that way. The word for to measure has been reconstructed as M-E-D, not P-L-E-U-K or something like that. It's always boom, 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 consonant, vowel, consonant. Except, and like all languages, Proto-Indo-European had its exceptions. It seems that there's some roots where when you reconstruct it using that same Snusos method, you find that you get these odd roots where instead of it being consonant, vowel, consonant, it's consonant, vowel, and then the vowel is long. And so, for example, the root for give is not D-O and then, for example, D. It's D-O and then the O is long, so it's do. Or if you have the root for to protect, it's P-A and the A is long, so pa. Now, it's just peculiar. One response to wrinkles is to kind of push them away because you're looking for patterns and you've got your taxes to pay. Another response to wrinkles is to think that might be treasure. That might tell you something that you didn't know before. Now, de Saussure was a visionary. He was a pioneer in linguistics in many ways. And he wanted to know, why would you have these long vowels? Where's the consonant at the end? And actually, the way he was thinking of it is, maybe those long vowels were in a way filling in the space where that third consonant was supposed to be. Because they're too long. They're stretching. It's almost like they're compensating for some kind of sense of inadequacy in the root. And so, what would be going on there? Why would it be long? Then he started thinking about good old H. And we've seen how H is fragile. And so just like horse can be pronounced orse in many dialects of English, in general, H, when you see it, is a sound that is always likely to be co-opted or bought off or dropped out or hurt or something. H can't really take care of itself. And so one thing that H does, and this is something you see in languages throughout the world, is that if H is the last consonant in a root, then often it drops away and leaves the vowel that came before it long. So in English, we don't have words like pa, where it's P-A-H, but that's very possible in the world. And also, we have to get away from spelling. So if I say P-A-H, we think, oh, that spells pa. But in many languages, that H would still be a consonant. So pa. And it's weird to us, and in terms of languages, that is fragile. Often when you have pa, the H drops away over time, but it leaves the A longer. That's just something that H does to a vowel. So something that is pa at stage A, at stage B, will be pa. That does happen. So de Saussure was thinking, well, if you've got these long vowels in Proto-Indo-European that really shouldn't be there, then maybe what's going on is that there used to be something like H in that slot. That would have made those roots normal. Bring it back into the pattern. So then you would have had, instead of do for to give, you would have had D-O-H. That's not do, but do, like that, in the original language. So he thought, well, let's say that that's it. That's the only thing that makes sense. Let's assume, now he didn't say exactly H, but he assumed that some sort of breathy consonant must have been in that slot. And he presented that to his colleagues, and he was rejected. He was laughed at. He was not allowed to join in any more reindeer games because there was no evidence of these sounds in any of the Indo-European languages that anyone knew. People can be so unimaginative. I know this from my own academic experiences. After a while, you're more caught up in administration than in doing research, and you're so busy talking about the last meeting with the vice dean or applying for grants that you lose your sense of imagination. You lose genuine interest in your own field. And I suspect that's what was going on with these people, to have so little interest in such a fascinating idea. And of course, I have no stake in this. All of this happened a century plus ago, but I can just imagine what it was like. So, as it happened, they found, after a time, tablets. And these tablets were found in what is now Turkey, and they were written in cuneiform script in what turned out to be a long-lost Indo-European language. Linguists now know this language as Hittite. So Hittite is one of the laterally discovered Indo-European languages. Hittite's a weird Indo-European language in many ways. One of the ways that it's weird is that in the case of things like do and pa, it actually had H. And so it showed that de Saussure was onto something. No modern Indo-European language has any remnant of it, but back in the days of Hittite, there was that H. So de Saussure was vindicated. And this is a wonderful thing. Today, Proto-Indo-European is reconstructed with those sounds in those places. They're called laryngeals. No one is exactly sure what sound it was. I'm using a shorthand to say that it was H, although it is written with that symbol on the Hittite tablets. But it was something somewhere in there. And that's what created, in a later stage of Proto-Indo-European, these peculiar long vowels. So that's an Indo-European story, and that was a major development, which showed that with a little bit of imagination, you can reconstruct something in the past that there's no evidence for today in any living language. There is one other tasty Indo-European story, and this is one that also involves the discovery of a long-lost Indo-European language. Hittite was one of several languages that are known from documents dug up in Turkey, and it was one of an Indo-European family that's extinct called Anatolian. In the 20th century, another one of these families was discovered. At the end of the 1800s, there were some Buddhist manuscripts discovered in western China, of all places. These dated as far back as 600 AD, and they were in a language which at that point was unknown. Now, luckily, the script was related to the one that is now used to write languages like Hindi, and the manuscripts were well-known Buddhist texts, and so you could kind of make your way as to the flow of what they were talking about and what the words were. Now, the language turned out to be unmistakably, and we're talking about Western China, turned out to be an Indo-European language. And you could see it very clearly. The word for night is noctim. And so you think about Spanish with noche, for example. And this was an Indo-European language. So, golly, what was it doing there? We didn't know what the name of this language was, and we didn't know who spoke it. But there it was. Imagine we're on a documentary, and somebody's holding these manuscripts, and the winds are blowing, and some exotic flute in the back goes, woo, something like that. And thought, what is this language? Well, as it happens, one of the documents was written in the Uyghur language, which is one of the languages related to Turkish and very similar to it, spoken far eastward of Turkey. And it said that this was in Uyghur, but it was translated from a language called roughly Twugru. And so it was T-W-G-H-R-Y. Now, that's all that we knew from those manuscripts, Twugru. But as it happens, Greek historians had a way of getting around, ancient Greek historians, and they told us quite a bit about civilizations that they encountered. Often most of what we know about a non-ancient Greek civilization is based on people like Herodotus and others going and providing on-site reportage. The reportage from our standards tends to be somewhat limited. It was often more about battles and political machinations than the anthropological details that interest us today. The ancient Greeks actually kind of frowned on describing populations in too much detail. They weren't usually interested in that. But very often these historians give us clues, which are all we have to go on, about obscure things going on when writing was still a marginal activity. And this is one of those cases. The Greek historians mention a people who began in the Fergana Valley. And the Fergana Valley is at the intersection of what today we call Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. And this is a place where these people began and migrated from, apparently to northern India, according to what the Greeks say. And they converted to Buddhism when they got down to India. Now, the Greeks give these people a name. They were apparently called the Tocharoi, the people that the Greeks refer to. Now, what's interesting is that there's a match between Tocharoi and this Twugru. The T is obvious. A W, if you think about it, has a relationship to an O. So To, Tu. Both of them are with the rounded kind of kissy mouth. And then you have Tocharoi, and then there's this Twigri, this G-H, K-H, similar kinds of sounds. They have the same relationship that T and D have. H, R. And so, it seems like there's something going on. Tocharoi, Twigr, and then this final vowel. So that seemed to indicate that maybe these manuscripts found in Western China had something to do with these people that the Greeks mentioned. Buddhist manuscripts converted to Buddhism, Tocharoi, Twigr. So, it's this shadow that's coming at us from the past. There are other clues, and it is now quite clear that the people that the Greeks mentioned were the people who are responsible for these manuscripts. And there are frescoes that were painted by Buddhists in Western China around 900 AD. And of all things, they depict Caucasian people, white people, and then there are mummies that have been found. And these mummies have ample facial hair, and this is in China, ample facial hair, long noses, light eyes, and many of them are very tall. And despite the fact that we tend to think that anybody who lived before 1900 was 3 feet tall, many of these people were 6 foot six, including some of the women. I don't remember if the women are 6 foot six, but they were not the 5 foot eight that we expect. Tall people. Obviously, these are not people of the description that anthropologists formally sometimes designate Mongoloid. These are people from a whole different part of the world. And you wonder, well, you know, what were they doing there? And yet there are even contemporary accounts in Chinese documents of whites in that area. So it appears that there were white people who migrated that far eastward, and they spoke an Indo-European language because they had come from the Indo-European speaking region. And they spoke a language which is now called Tocharian. There are even two dialects of it, but Tocharian is considered a lost branch of Indo-European. We can assume that there may have been others. All of which is a lesson that the languages that we have now are just what we have now. That's a Polaroid snapshot of a situation in an earlier world when we can assume that there were many, many other languages which, for various reasons, if they didn't evolve into other languages, then just died out. So, Tocharian is this lost branch. So, with Proto-Indo-European, it's a grand enterprise where what first moved people was looking at earlier Indo-European languages like Sanskrit and Latin and ancient Greek and reconstructing what Proto-Indo-European must have been like. You can get other clues by looking at the modern Indo-European languages. And then you can get even more clues from looking at Indo-European languages that are no longer spoken, but which fortuitously came along after writing had been invented, so that we can get some sense of what they are like. And so Hittite, has allowed us to reconstruct the mysterious laryngeals, the H-like sound. And we've learned even more about the diversity of Indo-European from Tocharian, which has also shed a lot of light upon the history of the region, which can be very difficult to pin down because of the many cultures that were there, because writing was often a marginal activity, and archaeology can often only take you so far. Not to mention that today, many of the places in question, because of geopolitical unpleasantnesses, are getting harder and harder to do archaeological research in. But the Proto-Indo-European enterprise is invaluable both to linguists and to historians, and it's very much a lively field today. There's a big debate going on right now over whether Indo-European emerged in what is now Turkey or in the southern steppes of Russia. There's a dynamic intersection between this and something which is advancing by leaps and bounds, which is looking at genetic markers of human populations around the world. So it's an exciting field. I'm anxiously awaiting what the consensuses will be, or lacks thereof, in about 10 years. And I wanted to share some of that with you in this lecture.